Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Today, we're going to have a crime show, basically, with a little something of a soap opera-ish business going on in the end. We'll start off with Crime and Peter Chambers. That's one of the later things done on radio. In this case, it was done in 1954, and it's entitled Charles Alvin, Druggist. And then we'll be back with a few more items, so stay tuned.
Crime and Peter Chambers. Created by Henry Kane, transcribed and starring Dane Clark. A private investigator, duly licensed and duly sworn. Peter Chambers.
You're a private eye. That's your business. Anything else? That's for laughs. The guy on the customer's end of your office desk? No laughs here. This one is strictly business. He's a round little man, balding on top, pudgy in the middle. He's got eyes like a vulture and a cranky voice.
Mr. Chambers, you've been highly recommended to me. You're supposed to be number one in your racket.
He chuckles with a phony heartiness, and the eyes crinkle up, vulture's eyes, with an extra set of bags under them. The upper set are dark bulbous circles from lack of sleep. The lower set are worry bags, purple and networked with wrinkles.
I'm out on a writ of habeas corpus, Mr. Chambers.
Yeah, and on a murder rack.
They haven't got a thing
now,
on
me. Just a minute, pal. Let's get some of our facts ironed out. Your name is Charles Avon.
Uh-huh.
You're a druggist here in New York.
Right.
You're married, and you've got no kids.
Correct. Wife's name is Nancy. Lives 1688 Gramercy Park North.
All right, now let's get to the meaty part. You're accused of the murder of one Alan Lewis.
Yeah.
Used to be a clerk in your drugstore.
That's right.
Police claim you killed him Monday, which is yesterday, yesterday evening, at his Park Avenue apartment. Park Avenue?
Yeah, so they claim.
Well, did you kill him, Mr. Avon?
Absolutely not.
And my job?
Is to find out who did kill him, so that I don't have to carry that burden around, too.
What's the other burden, Mr. Avon?
Well, there are two sides to every question. In my business, I don't...
All right, we'll skip that temporarily. Now, let's see. The cops hauled you in for the murder of your clerk.
Ex-clerk. He hadn't been working for me for a year. Living off the fat of the land.
Why'd they pick on you, Miss Avon?
Because I was supposed to be there last night at 8 o'clock. That's when it happened to him. And also, I'm supposed to have a motive for his murder.
Well, did you have a motive?
Well, if a guy's been blackmailing you for a year...
Blackmail? What do you have on you, Mr. Avon?
Well, now, I don't know that I...
Ma, let's have it.
Well, narcotics.
Narcotics?
We had a deal going, sort of, with the narcotics. The lawyer knows all about it.
I want to know.
Well, I was looking for easy money, and I'm doing all right. This Alan Lewis, he learns about it. He was working for me, you understand, and he starts holding me up.
And so last night, when he's murdered...
I came there to talk with him, but he wasn't home. That's all, he wasn't home. Then last night, the police picked me up, and I don't even know what they're talking about.
Who's your lawyer?
Richard Evans, Dick Evans. Oh. You know him?
Yeah, I know Dick.
Mr. Chambers, you've got to help me out of this jam.
Not the narcotics, pal.
No, the murder.
And it'll cost you 5,000 simoleons.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
Cash on the barrel head. I don't trust guys like you.
Okay, but I don't have it on me. If you'll accompany me to the bank,
I can't say I admire my choice of companion.
You're an insulting
Let's
one,
Let's go, Mr. Avon. We'll discuss it on the way. You get to the bank and you're paid, and you kiss him off like you'd kiss off a king cobra that just became a client. But if the guy's not guilty of murder, it's your job to prove it. That's what you're being paid for. So you get rid of him, and you go downtown to the offices of B. Richard Evans, Regal Legal Eagle. Hi, honey. Mr. Evans in?
I'm in, all right, Pete. Come on, I've been expecting you.
Hi, Dick. How are things going?
Fine, Petey. Come right on in.
Okay. Dick Evans, boy lawyer. Black hair, beak nose, and cyclone cellar voice. A two-tone personality split at 5 o'clock. Tricky as a slippery bath mat before the deadline, but afterward, wide open and roaring. a wielder of martinis, like a good farmer with a pitchfork.
What brings you, Mr. Detective?
Charles Avon, Dick. How easy was it getting him out on that writ?
Easier than getting stepped on in the subway.
Because why, Counselor?
Because the prosecution doesn't have a thing on
him. Well, I got motive.
Motive isn't murder, Mr. Chambers.
Well, how'd that guy get it, that Alan Lewis?
Two bullets. One ripped through his right shoulder, rather unimportant. The second one pasted in over his right eye. Very important.
Prosecution got the gun?
No, sir, they don't. All they got is motive, period. They gave him a 9-hour grilling, and all they could come up with was motive.
Okay, okay, okay. Now, what about the other charge?
What other charge?
The narcotics.
Well, I'm going to plead him guilty on that. He ought to get a light sentence because without Alan Lewis, they've hardly got a case.
Well, here comes motive again for the death of Alan Lewis.
Well, the police know all about that. How much good has it done them?
By the way, how do they know? Who told them?
Frankie Tokers.
Frankie Tokers. Male or female?
Female, but good and female. You're going to like that when you come to it.
I like it already, just from looking at your face.
Have another slice of motive, Mr. Chambers. This one's on Frankie. She was engaged to Alan Lewis.
That's motive?
Not yet, it's not, but this is. She's the beneficiary on his insurance policy for $30,000. Plus, she's the one who informed the police that the Lewis boy was putting the touch on Avon for the blackmail.
Well, how'd she know?
Her boyfriend confided in her.
Oh. Well, how'd she stand suspect-wise?
Oh, she's got an alibi, don't they all?
Frankie Togan.
A very gorgeous number. He sings at the Rumpus Room with an equally gorgeous blonde partner with whom you will kindly have no truck.
Why?
Because that one is sort of reserved for me.
Do you have this Frankie Toker's phone number, Dick?
Got it written down somewhere. Name, address, and phone number. Ah, here you are.
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Cute little trick. That's Frankie.
Hello.
Miss Tokers?
This is Miss Tokers.
Collins from the insurance company. There's been a slight complication. May I come to see you?
Well, when?
Oh, right away. The sooner the better.
Well, all right, if you insist. I should be here most of the afternoon.
Ah, good. I'll see you shortly then. Bye, Miss Tokers. So you leave the lawyer and you go visit the lady. This is supposed to be the part the private eye enjoys, but don't make book on that. Because most of the dear ladies turn out to look like bats on a vacation from the Belfry. This one happily doesn't. Miss Tokers?
Yes, I'm Miss Tokers.
Mr. Collins from the insurance company.
Oh, yes. Please come in.
Frankie Tokers. She's wearing a hostess gown, a metallic number in gold. Imagine that wrapped around a dream-bunched figure. Frankie Tokers. Tall, with an oval face and wide dark eyes that glint like brandy bottles under bar lights. You don't fool around with a kid like that.
Mr. Collins?
I'm sorry. My name's not Collins, Miss Tokers, and I'm not from the insurance company. My name's Chambers, Peter Chambers. I'm a private detective. And they tell me that you're on a spot.
Get out.
Now, just a minute.
Get out, get out, I tell you.
Look, lady, I think you've got me pegged wrong.
Please, oh, please.
You explain the situation, and tears come up in the blackberry brandy eyes. Naturally, you put your arm around her, and just as naturally, she puts her head on your shoulder. A sobbing brunette close in the arms of the private detective. There you have the classic situation. But you've been paid $5,000 to find out who killed Cock Robin, so reluctantly you break it up. No. I know how you feel, Miss Tokers. You love the guy, but he's dead.
Not true.
Huh?
I hated him.
You were engaged to be married, weren't you?
That was going to end when I found out what he was really like.
And whose idea was that $30,000 life policy with you as beneficiary?
His. His, of course. But that was going to be finished, too.
Hmm.
Mr. Chambers, I couldn't tell the police, but I will tell you.
Why?
Because I want you to help me.
Look, sister, you didn't kill him, did you?
Oh, no. Listen, last night, the night he was killed, I went there. I was going to tell him off and finish it off completely.
What time?
9:00. It was between shows. I'm a singer at the Rumpus Room.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, when I got there, there was no answer. I kept ringing, but there was no answer, and I was worried. I went back to the club, and I called on the phone. No answer. Then I called the police and told them that there was trouble there. I didn't say who was calling.
Oh, now, wait, hold up just for a minute. First, why the police just because the guy's not home? And second, how did you know there was trouble there?
Because I knew that he had an appointment with Mr. Charles Avon for 8 o'clock. And it was going to be a long talk. And I knew what the talk was about.
And what was it about?
About more money. More blackmail money.
Oh, I see. It figured for a trouble party, huh?
Yes.
And when the guy didn't answer at 9 o'clock, was your idea that the trouble had exploded?
Exactly. And 1 hour after the phone call, the police were at the club, investigating the murder of Alan Lewis. I told them everything I knew about the narcotics that Mr. Avon was dealing in and about Alan's blackmail, and about how he was going to raise the ante at this meeting between them.
Well, it answers why Charles Avon was picked up. What about your alibi?
I fixed that up with my singing partner. I arranged for her to say that I'd been with her all the time, in our dressing room. But I'm scared, Mr. Chambers. I'm sick scared inside of me. Help me. Please help me.
Oh, Miss Tokers, I'd hate it if you did put those slugs into Alan.
I didn't. Oh, I didn't.
She's asking for it. And you answer. You take her face in your hands, put your lips on hers, and you leave them there. With excellent results. But then you quit. You crash out of there and you're heading for police headquarters. But you detour for Charles Avon's drugstore.
Good to see you again, Mr. Chambers.
Hi, I was thinking I might want to drop into your home tonight. Would you be there perhaps later on?
No, but my wife will. Oh, you don't know her. Oh, she's here right now. I'd very much like to have you meet her. Nancy?
Yes?
My dear, Peter Chambers, the gentleman I told you about. My wife, Nancy Avon.
She's a small blonde, too young and too pretty for Charlie Boy. She's wearing gold-rimmed black lens goggles and you can't see her eyes. She's smooth-skinned and good-looking, but jumpy, nervous as a lion tamer who's lost his whip.
Did you wish to speak to me, Mr. Chambers?
Very much, but I don't have the time now. May I speak with you later?
Of course, but I'm leaving for home now.
Well, may I call you there?
Well, it's a little upset. It's Maid's Day off, but if you wish...
I wish. See you later. Bye, Mr. and Mrs. Avon. And so you're riding your broom again, making time for police headquarters, and then you're there.
Come in. Well, Pete, to what do I owe the honor?
Charles Avon, Louis, a paid-up client.
So, maybe you think you can do more than cops can do, huh?
I doubt it, but I can try. Detective Lieutenant Louis Parker, homicide. Thick set and sturdy like a brand new refrigerator and just about as enthusiastic. But a good cop. And mostly a good friend.
What's pitch?
I'm being paid $5,000 to find out who put the chill on Alan Lewis.
Well, $5,000 to do what we'd do anyway, huh? Brother, yours is one business. Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you want?
Help.
That's hot. You're getting 5 G's. What do we get?
Well, any information happens to fall my way, and no byline, you get all the credit. You buying?
What do you want, kid?
Well, I'd like to see the inside of Alan Lewis's apartment.
I'll buy that. In fact, I'll go with you.
Got a cop staked out there?
Nobody's staked out there. I've got better things to do with cops than having them sitting around getting fat. Okay, what else?
Anything else that's not too terribly confidential?
Not this case, Petey. We got us a nice fat group of nothing.
Well, then that's it, Lieutenant. Let us go look at apartments. Alan Lewis's joint turns out to be the usual bachelor's flat fitted out to please the ladies. Parker snoozes in the bedroom while you poke around like a critical matron seeking dust in the upholstery. In the library, a book sticks out like a sore thumb in a working pickpocket. You pull it out and an envelope drips to the floor. You pick that up and examine it. It's slid on top and it contains a letter. It's addressed to Mrs. Nancy Avon, 1688 Gramercy Park, North New York City. You don't stop to read the letter. You stick it in your pocket and you're ready to leave. Then Parker comes into the room yawning.
Oh, you finished, Sherlock?
All done. Let's get out of here. By the way, I assume you guys gave this place a going over.
Yeah, most of last night. Been through this apartment with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah, a fine-tooth comb.
Hey, is that a crack?
No crack intended, Lieutenant. Leave us leave.
Yeah, leave us.
Outside, Parker goes off and you're left alone. Frankie Toker's place is nearby and... Well, maybe you're looking for an excuse to go back.
Hello, Mr. Chambers.
Oh, may I come in?
Please do.
You bring her up to date, you take the letter out of the envelope, and you read. Dear Nancy, finished is finished. Now you've got it in writing. I don't see the sense, but if you insist, you can come over Monday at 7:30. You can't stay long. As it happens, I have a date with Charles for 8 o'clock. Yours, Alan.
The date matches. Monday, yesterday.
The night he was killed.
That letter puts her right in the middle, doesn't it?
Say, do you know anything about these two, Nancy Avon and Alan Lewis?
She was sweet on him, and he encouraged her.
Oh?
Charlie Avon didn't even know it was cooking, but she was planning to divorce him. And then Alan Lewis cooled off.
You mean, when he met you?
He'd have cooled off anyway. That's the kind of guy he was. Real loyal. Shot through with integrity.
Well, how'd she take it, you know?
He told me. She was plenty worked up over it.
Okay, Miss Tokers. Frankie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you cross your fingers, and if I'm lucky, you're out of a jam.
Oh, I'd appreciate that. Would I appreciate that?
You figure your next stop for your last stop. 1688 Gramercy Park North.
Oh, Mr. Chambers. Please come in.
Mrs. Avon. She's dressed in Chinese-type lounging pajamas, and she's not wearing the dark lens specs. You look at her eyes, and a chill goes through you like winter's suddenly gotten into the marrow of your bones. Wild eyes, quick-moving, darting, half-mad eyes. The pupils dilated almost to the rim.
Something, Mr. Chambers?
A few questions.
Questions? Why questions of me?
Well, I've got a hunch I've stumbled on something the police don't know.
Like what?
Like you had a thing going with Alan Lewis. Your husband, you hope, didn't know about it.
But I...
There are letters. You saved them. Right, Mrs. Avon?
Yes.
You were there last night?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Avon. Now, where's the gun? Do you have it?
You say the police don't know. Perhaps, I mean, I have
Look,
money.
I'm one of the dumb ones. I'm allergic to bribery. Now, where's the gun?
I have it. It's hidden here, hidden in the apartment.
Will you get it, please?
Yes. Yes, I'll get it. It's my own gun.
You wait while she goes for it, and you don't like it. But you haven't got the time to work it out now, because she's coming back, and she's carrying the thing, a chunky nickel-plated item. And she's holding it, business end forward. You get a scratched hip and a hole in your pants. And you're all ready to slug her, but you don't have to, because she slides down in a faint. You get the gun away from her, find brandy, pour a lot into her, and a little into yourself. And finally, she starts coming to.
I fainted.
You certainly did, lady.
I'm ill. I'm under the care of a psychiatrist. Gunshot, the sound of gunshot. One shot, and I pass out. Even if I do it myself, I pass out.
What happened last night?
Almost like it happened here. I was there before he was, and when he came, we argued. I brought the pistol. I was wearing my gloves, and I shot him. And then I fainted. When I came to, I saw he was dead, and I got out of there.
Now, just a minute. You say you were there before he was? How'd you get in?
I have keys.
You get her to an easy chair, and you call down to Parker at headquarters. You put in a request for a lot of the law, and also for Mr. Charles Avon. Pretty soon, the place is crawling with cops, and you point a finger, and to Lieutenant Parker, you say, I give you a murderer, Lieutenant.
But you've got it wrong. You're mistaken.
No mistake. It's just where my finger's pointing. I give you, Lieutenant, Mr. Charles Avon.
This guy's nuts.
A lot of things he is. Nuts he ain't. Go on,
no.
Pete.
Here's a guy who comes in and hires me for $5,000 for something the New York City police can do much better and for nothing.
You're stealing my lines, chump.
But the guy's not crazy. He's got a purpose. He's also got a large contempt for the thoroughness of the police, which I haven't.
Start making sense, Petey boy.
Read this. You toss the letter to Detective Lieutenant Parker, and the room is as quiet as a cemetery until he's through reading it.
So?
I found that letter from Mrs. Avon to Alan Lewis. I found it in Lewis's apartment.
Now, wait a minute. We gave that place an extra special going over. That letter wasn't there, Pat.
You don't have to convince me. Convince Charles Avon. That baby goes and sees the wrong movies. He's got no confidence in cops.
No question. The letter wasn't there.
But I found it there, so it adds up to plant. Somebody planted it there, wanted it found there. Somebody wanted to implicate Mrs. Nancy Avon.
Who?
Who had access to her mail? Huh? Friend husband, that's who.
No.
Why do you think he hired me? So I could bumble around and find a few things he wanted me to find. Like frustrated love, like that letter, like maybe a confession from Mrs. Avon, which I got.
She confessed?
Doesn't mean a thing. Let me do it chronologically, will you, Pete?
Do it any way you like, pal.
Nancy Avon goes there at 7:30 to keep her date.
Yes.
She brings her gun because the young guy's giving her the air. She waits for him, he comes, they argue, she shoots him, and she faints. One shot.
But the guy had two bullet holes in it.
Correct. But here's how he got the second. Charles Avon's got a hate for both of them, for Alan and for Nancy. Alan's been blackmailing him, plus the wife is sweet on Alan. He's been steeping open her mail, and he knows she's going to meet him last night, so he follows. He follows, hoping against hope for action, and action happens.
And then?
He gets in there, he sees Alan bleeding from the shoulder wound, and the wife in a faint on the floor. He picks up the gun, finishes off Alan, wipes the prints off, puts it back in her hand, and vamooses. She comes to, sees the dead Alan, and she gets out convinced that she killed him.
And then we pick up Charlie on the strength of Miss Toker's story, but the lawyer gets him sprung on a writ.
Right. So this morning, he goes to Lewis's apartment, and he sticks that letter where it can't be missed.
No, I...
Real contempt he has for the efficiency of cops, hasn't he? Anyway, he hires me so I can clean up some loose ends and lay the whole deal in the lady's lap. The minute I saw that letter, I knew it was a plant. It happens that I've got respect for cops. They'd never miss that kind of evidence.
One great big catch.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
What?
How did he get in there twice? Once to croak the guy and once to plant the letter.
Correct.
Mrs. Avon had keys. Mr. Avon made duplicates. He figured he'd have use for them sooner or later. Well, he used them all right, and by now he's disposed of them. But he hasn't disposed of the key maker.
Meaning what?
Meaning that when a guy swipes his wife's keys to make duplicates, he doesn't go far. So you can demonstrate to Mr. Avon about the efficiency of cops by producing, and with dispatch, the neighborhood keymaker who did the job, and that will put the final finger on Mr. Charles Avon.
No, I didn't.
All right, Mr. Avon.
That does it. Charles Avon goes white and topples, and when he gets up, the manacles are around his wrist, and he's babbling his brains out. Lawyer or no lawyer, this time he's going to get locked away for good.
Nice work. Grade A job, Petey. Congratulations.
Well, now. Appreciation from a detective lieutenant to a private eye, that's sweet music indeed. But you start breaking out of there because you're heading for Frankie Toker's place. Appreciation from Detective Lieutenant Parker, good enough. But appreciation from Miss Frankie Toker's, well, no.
And there you've had Crime and Peter Chambers. Dane Clark was starred as Peter Chambers. Crime and Peter Chambers transcribed was created and written by Henry Kane. Bill Zuckert was heard as Lieutenant Parker, with Leslie Woods, Edgar Staley, and Lawson Zerbe. It was directed by Fred Way. This is Fred Collins inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same station, for Dane Clark in Crime and Peter Chambers. Hear the Oppenheimer story on Heart of the News, tonight on the NBC Radio Network.
Next up is Sam Spade Detective from 1951. This is called The Soap Opera Caper, and it will be followed by a real soap opera, so stay tuned.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The Adventures of Sam Spade Detective.
Detective agency.
Me, sweetheart.
Was it awful, sir?
Excruciating. If I suffered, girl, how I suffered.
But there's no other way, sir.
Hmm?
When fate turns against a man.
True, dear one, true. But from somewhere I must find strength.
You must.
To pick up the shattered fragments of my life, to raise my eyes once again to the horizon and piece by piece put them together again.
Oh, sir.
And the two of us, dear one, hand in hand, shall go marching down the years together.
Oh, yes.
Brace yourself, sweetheart.
I'll try, Sam.
Gather together the homely, humble tools of your trade. Find 6 dry handkerchiefs and prepare to greet me with a smile behind the tears. I'll be down before you can change stations with a report entitled The Soap Opera Caper.
For NBC, William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, brings you the greatest private detective of them all in The Adventures of Sam Spade.
Sam?
Who called, young widder Perrine?
Plain F. Is it all over, Sam?
Is a soap opera ever over, dear one?
Oh, but it's not on the phone like you...
I know, but it's not the end. It's never the end. Pull up a chair now. Take a firm grip on pad, pencil, and your emotions. Got them?
I'm at the ready, Sam.
Good show. To Agatha Pilbeam, from Samuel Spade, license number 137596. Subject, The Soap Opera Caper. How was I to know what was on her mind? This strange woman, this mysterious Agatha Pilbeam, this voice on the telephone, directing me to the big, sprawling house in Hillsborough.
Is that clear, Mr. Spade?
How urgent is it, Miss Pilbeam?
Very, very urgent, Mr. Spade. I don't know which way to turn.
So I went to the big sprawling house in Hillsborough, pulled up behind an ancient Model A parked at the curb, and was walking past it toward the gate when...
Spade.
Huh? Oh, Throckmorton, isn't it?
Good old Sammy, you remember.
Yeah. When'd you get out?
Last month, but I'm a good boy now. Here, take one of my cards. Yeah, if you know anyone who needs a first-class private eye, Croc's available. What are you doing here, Sam?
The lady wants to see me.
The soap opera queen?
Is that what she is?
Sure, 6 or 8 of them she writes. Oh? Behind the Clouds, The Heart of Julia Jukes, I forget the rest.
Yeah.
Beats Gumshoe and Sammy.
Yeah, well, write if you get work, Croc.
Yeah, I'm on a job right now.
You mean you got your license already?
Oh, me? Well,
you can always run off a photostat of someone else's.
Oh, Sam, that's mean.
Crack was a crook, but a nice crook. He never killed anybody. He was just an uncurable camera fiend, specializing in taking pictures of people doing what they hadn't ought to be doing, you know, stuff like that. Or if you wanted a photostat of somebody else's document, Crack was your man. Well, I walked up the drive to the door, threw it past a white shirt front that turned out to have a butler in it, and toward what seemed to be your study. But it wasn't. It was your bedroom, and you were reclining on 6 pillows with a cigarette in a long holder in one hand and a mouthpiece of a dictating machine in the other.
But, John, hush, Melinda, there is no way to go now but ahead. John, you're so strong. I need you. I need your courage. We must face this thing together, Melinda.
The organ
what
was
Veronica
a phonograph
says,
playing in her ear.
There is indeed.
I waited for an opening, but there just wasn't any, so I had to interrupt.
John, don't even...
Miss Pilbeam.
Don't you see, Melinda, we can't run away from life.
Miss...
We must approach this...
Miss Pilbeam?
Calmly, Melinda. beg your pardon. Just a minute. My mood music.
I see. I'm Sam Spade, Miss Pilbeam.
Come sit beside me, Mr. Spade.
Well?
It's time we talked things over.
Well, thanks. Maybe you'd better start at the...
When a woman reaches 40, Mr. Spade, she comes to lean upon her man.
Oh?
To look upon him not just as someone to cherish, but as a source, a spring, a fountain of strength.
Mm-hmm. Are you still dictating?
I'm talking about me, Mr. Spade.
Oh.
Whom can I turn to? Whom? I grope, I flounder in the darkness, I cry out, I listen in vain for an answer. But there is none.
Well, you always have a better chance of getting an answer when you ask a question.
What do you mean?
What are we talking about?
What indeed?
Well, I haven't caught the show lately. You'll have to bring me up to date. Why don't you run through the announcer's part, will you? You know, right after the organ, when he says, when we left Julia Jukes yesterday...
I'm sorry, I thought I told you on the telephone.
No.
For many days now, I've seen somewhat of a strange new look on my husband's face.
Husband?
Dr. Martin Hawke.
Oh, you're married. I thought it was Miss Agatha Pilbeam.
Well, 2 years ago today, I met young Dr. Hawkes and married him. Life became beautiful, a gay, laughing thing, a road to happiness. And then...
Then?
A cloud passed over the sun. Martin became moody, silent. I tried to penetrate the shell, but he only drew farther into it. A strange, terrifying crevasse seemed to have opened up between us.
Well.
What is it, Martin? I asked him repeatedly. But he'd only stare silently out the window and finally walk silently from the room.
Well, how long did this go on? How long a series did you get out of it?
For a week until a few days ago when the final blow fell.
Mm.
It was evening, and Agatha and Martin were at dinner. Let's look in on them as... Oh, sorry. We were at dinner when the doorbell rang, and I answered it. It was a telegram for Martin from Mexico. I gave it to him and watched the blood drain from his handsome features as he read it. His hand trembled, his jaw clenched.
But you forced yourself to speak.
Yes. What is it, Martin, I asked. Tell me, please, for the sake of our love.
And he...
looked down at me as if I were a stranger. Then he crumpled the telegram, threw it savagely into the fireplace, and strode silently from the room. Here I wrested it from the flames. Read it.
Thank you. Regret must confirm your worst fears, Cardoza.
What is the terrible secret of Martin Hawk?
Yes.
Why did he act so strangely when the mysterious telegram arrived from Mexico? And above all, where is he?
You mean he didn't come back?
He's been gone for 4 days, Mr. Spade. I must find him. Now, of all times, I need his love. When a woman reaches 40...
I know. What do you mean, now, of all times?
It's been just a week now since the report came back from the laboratory after my physical examination.
Oh.
The doctor from Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Mr. Spade, I, too, have a terrible secret.
Well, don't you want to tell me about it?
Yes. I have a very rare, incurable disease. There are only 6 short weeks to live.
Well, less than an hour after his distressing interview with Agatha, our boy Sammy walked into the beautifully appointed office of young Dr. Hawkes at 450 Sutter to find his nurse, pretty young Nora Sheldrake, a new character, working at her desk in the reception room. In response to a question from Sammy, we hear Nora saying...
I have no idea where Martin has gone, Mr. Spade, but I can tell you why.
Tell me, Nora. Please feel free to tell me everything.
It's that woman, Mr. Spade.
Agatha?
Yes. Yes, Agatha.
Mm-hmm.
She never understood Martin. She doesn't understand Martin. She never has tried to understand Martin, do you hear me? She never has tried.
I take it you don't care for Agatha Pilbeam.
I hate her.
Nora?
I do, I hate her. She thinks her money can buy everything, even Martin. Well, it won't. She knows that now.
Well, calm yourself, Nora. Try and think back now to the last time you saw Martin Hawkes.
It was Monday.
4 days ago?
Yes. The call came from some legal firm named Bennett and Hatch.
Now, let me write that down.
I switched the call into Martin. I was worried for him. I was concerned. I have to admit now I did a terrible thing.
Ah, you listened in.
I did. They told him his sister was in town, that she was working at some nightclub and wanted to see him.
What nightclub was this?
Let me see. It was the Tortuga.
Mm-hmm. What else?
That's all. They hung up then, and Martin came out. I watched the blood drain from his handsome features.
His hand trembled, his jaw clenched.
Yes. I'm going out, Nora, he said. If I'm not back, don't worry. That's all. It was so like Martin.
The Tortuga was only a few blocks away on Post Street, so I walked there. were just tooling up for the dinner trade when I arrived, sailed around backstage like Billy Rose on an inspection tour, found the doorman and showed him the snapshot you'd given me of young Dr. Hawks. Or tried to.
Look, young fella, I told you we don't have no dancer here named Hawks. I ain't got
look,
time
to... Doorman, doorman, please, take a look at the picture.
No, I ain't got the... Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm? That fellow was here. Tuesday, Monday night it was.
Well, who'd he come to see?
Wasn't nobody named Hawks, mister. It was Beth Jardine.
Well, bless you, Dorman. Bless you.
Bless you, too.
Thank you. Beth Jardine. Huh?
Come in.
Oh. I.
Close the door, will you?
Yeah.
Drafty.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything I can.
There sure is. Zip me up, Jack.
I'm Sam.
I don't care if you're Boris Karloff. You got hands, haven't you?
Well.
Zip me up.
Okay. Say when.
When?
Can you breathe?
Oh, no. You can't have everything. Out. What's on your mind, Jack?
Martin Hawks.
Sorry, never heard of him.
Look, we're getting along beautifully up to now, honey. Let's not spoil it. You not only know Martin Hawks, you're his sister.
What makes you think
What's I that know? Card stuck over there in the mirror? Bennett and Hatch, attorneys at law. Aha! The same Bennett and or Hatch who called Martin Monday afternoon and told him his sister wanted to see him here. Now, what's this all about?
I can't tell you.
He got a telegram from Mexico.
Mexico?
Yeah. It upset him something awful.
What did it say?
Regret must confirm your worst fears.
You're dead, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Great.
Pretty hilarious, huh?
Jackie just ain't got no idea. I got a piece of advice for you, Jack.
Oh?
Forget about Marty Hawks and live a long and useful life.
Mm-hmm. I got a tip for you, too. You're in a tight spot. Watch that zipper, Jack. One of the heavier soap opera types, Beth was, with a throaty voice and the talent for besmirching reputation. What was the mysterious influence she wielded over young Dr. Hawks? How much did she know about his strange disappearance? What about the cryptic telegram from Mexico City? And what about dinner? The last question I could answer. I stopped at Schroeder's for sauerbraten and potato pancakes, ran into Larry Mahoney of Homicide, who was off duty, and we stopped in at a handy alley and bowled until 11. I was walking back down Market Street when I passed the Flood Building, which reminded me of the firm of Bennett and Hatch, who resided there. As a matter of fact, it looked like they were there right now, since the light was on behind the second floor window with their name on it. Now, the sensible thing would have been to call around 9 in the morning, but as I seldom do sensible things, I hustled up the stairs and down the corridor to their office. Someone other than Bennett or Hatch had put in some time, obviously. The drawers of a dozen or more file cases had been pulled out and dumped on the floor, the desk drawers likewise. And to mark it clearly as the work of a thoroughgoing professional, the safe door was off its hinges. All this took me back to the Model A parked in front of your house this afternoon, Agatha, and I was contemplating same when... Oh. Hello?
Bennett.
Yeah?
Good, first of all, I was scared you wouldn't be there. Try to get you home. Do it, baby, do it. Pull the string. We'll never make it with this guy. We're through. Pull the string here. Do it, baby, do it. Make it...
Hello? Operator. Operator. Operator! I finally got someone at the Tortuga Club who knew where Beth Jardine lived, an apartment on Russian Hill. I didn't stop to ask which apartment, and when I got there, I found I didn't have to.
All right, stand back, everybody! Stand back!
Dugan!
Hello, Sam.
What happened?
Dame just knocked herself off.
Huh?
Jumped from a room on the eighth floor. Stand back, you yowls!
There was no need to, but I looked at her anyway, just to make sure. It was Beth, all right. When she said she was through, she meant it. I was just turning to go when something big in a tan camel's hair brushed past me and bent over the body.
Where is she? Where? Beth! Sister! Beth! Beth! Oh!
I recognized him from the snapshot. Wild haired, with a 4 days' growth of beard on his lean, handsome face. It was Martin Hawks, on the verge of collapse. Officer Dugan and I helped him through the crowd toward the ambulance that had just rolled up. sat him on the running board and began to question him.
What? What was ever done?
Your name, your name. What's your name?
My name. Of course, I don't know. I don't know my name.
It happens to everyone in soap operas, sooner or later. When he filled out the forms on poor Beth Jardine, old Doc Peterson gave Martin a double O, blew his nose, and announced with a twinkle in his eye,
"Here's to me like young Dr. Hawks has got himself a case of amnesia."
Will the mind of young Dr. Hawks come out of the fog? What does he know about the death of Beth? Was it murder or suicide or both? And what of the mysterious telegram from Mexico City? Will Agatha ever discover the terrible secret of young Dr. Hawks? And will stupid Sam ever discover anything? Before we continue, a word from our announcer. You are listening to the weekly adventure of radio's most famous detective, Sam Spade. Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Saturday night is date night, but tomorrow poor Dennis Day has trouble with his girlfriend Gloria. However, Dennis manages to sing his way out of trouble in his charming, boyish fashion. And say, why not let Dennis help your Saturday evening along, too? And for more music and fun tomorrow, there's the Judy Canova Show, starring Judy in a melodic and carefree half hour of laughs. And Grand Ole Opry with singing MC Red Foley and his special guest, cowboy troubadour Ernie Tubb. And now back to the soap opera caper, tonight's adventure with Sam Spade. It's a half hour later now in the sterile whiteness of a hospital room that the three of us, you, Agatha, I, and old Doc Peterson, gather around the pale, quiet form of young Dr. Hawks.
Martin, speak to me. Martin, darling.
Who are you?
Agatha, dear. Your own Agatha.
Come, Agatha. Better leave him be for now.
Zach, I can't go on when a woman really...
I know. You got to be strong, Agatha. Sam, We better leave him be for now.
Well, you're the doctor.
Oh, Doc, what could have done this to Martin?
Oh, shock sometimes.
You don't mean...
Yes, I'm afraid I do.
Seeing his sister then?
Could be. Or sometimes it's just a matter of a body getting into such a fix his mind backs off and refuses to have any part of it.
The wire from Mexico City.
Eh?
His terrible secret. The strange threat hanging over him and his sister. Driving one to suicide. And the other... Did he?
Well...
No wonder poor Martin gave away before this.
Sure. And there's still another explanation.
How's that, Sam?
That he figured amnesia was a nice, easy way not to have to account for what he's been up to for the last 4 days. Or where he was when the dame took off from the 8th story.
Mr. Spade, you're not accusing Martin.
There's something buzzing around in his little mind. The nurse tells me she got him into a pair of pajamas and tucked him in nice and cozy before we got here.
Well?
Yes, well?
You may not have noticed, Agatha, because he'd pulled the covers up around his neck, but our boy had his clothes back on just now.
What? Martin! Hey! He's gone!
Indeed he was Martin, as we could plainly deduce from the open window and the curtains blowing gently out over the fire escape. Young Dr. Hawks, indeed, had packed up his amnesia, his terrible secret, and his toothbrush, and taken off into the night. So I left you sobbing gently on old Doc's shoulder and found me a phone in a drugstore a safe distance away, on the 48th ring. Bennett of Bennett and Hatch Attorneys answered. He was sleepy. I used all my soft answers, and he used all his hard ones, and finally we got to the point.
All right, Spade, all right. The Jardine dame left a sealed envelope with us.
What was in it?
How do I know? It was sealed, marked personal and confidential, to be delivered to the city attorney in the event of my death. Signed Beth Jardine Hawk.
Signed how?
Beth Jardine Hawk.
Not Beth Hawks Jardine.
No. Is it important?
Just a tiresome detail, Bennett. So she brought you the envelope, paid you a fee, and you stuck it in the vault for her. Then what?
Well, she had us call her brother and tell him to meet her at the Tortuga. Period. That ended our part of it. We didn't even get our feet wet.
On the contrary, Bennett, you're up to your ears.
In what?
Blackmail. Bye. Which explained many things, to wit, A, the wire from Mexico City from a lawyer named Cardoza, B, the murder of Beth Jardine, and C, the reason for young Dr. Hawk's mysterious flight from the hospital, his mind still fogged with amnesia. It did not, however, explain why stupid Sam had kept Croc Morton's business card in his vest pocket for 21 pages without doing something about it. The address was near 3rd and Howard. Not one of the better business sections, even for a private detective. I walked down 3rd Street past the Sherry and Muscatel joints, looking at numbers, and then discovered it wasn't necessary. The old Model A was pulled up in front of white, what might have been a respectable office building before the earthquake, but now couldn't decide whether to be a warehouse or a tenement. Thus far, a harmonious picture. But behind the Model A was something twice as long and three times as shiny with a motor running. Out of place by about $4,000. Out kind of late, aren't you, Nora?
Sam!
Nora.
Sam!
Nora. Don't reach for the horn.
But he told me...
Sure, and you believed it, like everything else he told you. Come on, get out.
I will not get out.
Oh, but you will. I'll pull you out by your pretty blonde hair. Come on.
You...
There. There. That's it.
You can't do this to me, Mr. Spade. Nothing can stop Martin and me. We have our right to happiness.
Uh-huh. Just the two of you. Chins up, eyes on the horizon. Let the dead past bury its dead.
How can you joke
about... It's no joke, believe me. You got taxi fare?
Why?
Because you're going to get in my cab, go home, put your hair up in curlers, and go to bed. After saying to yourself 1,000 times, what a lucky little girl you are that Martin Hawks didn't shove you out a window, too. Now, scoot. Scoot! It was a kind of a dark stairway that made me yearn for the comfortable feel of a shoulder holster under my left arm. At the top was a 3.5-watt bulb, and at the other end of the hallway, a crack of light under Croc's office door. Between the two was a cat, more's the pity. So abandoning my stealthy approach, I walked up to the door, turned the knob, stuck my hand in my side coat pocket like Edward G. Robinson, and kicked the door open. Croc was sitting at his desk behind a stack of bills. The closet door was just closing softly. Who was in the closet? And did he still have his toothbrush, his terrible secret, and his amnesia with him?
Well, Johnny.
Yeah.
You took me up on it right quick, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, have a chair.
I sat on a chair in the corner out of line of the closet door behind the desk.
Oh, Sammy. Mm-hmm. You got a job for me, huh?
Yeah. You don't look like you need a job, Croc.
Oh, this?
Yeah.
Oh, this is nothing. Good day at the track, that's all. What's on your mind?
Remember the Blennerhassett job?
Huh?
The one with the letters before you went up?
What are you talking about, Sam?
The shakedown, Croc. The dame who wanted you to get the letters back, remember? You know, so you got them for her, delivered and collected after you had the photostats made.
Sam, you're crazy. I never done no such thing.
You can level with me, Croc. You collected on the photostats for 8 years.
Oh, wait, Sam.
Well, forget it. Anyway, I got another one. Dr. Martin Hawks, married to the soap opera queen, you know.
What about it, Sam?
She's worth a couple of million bucks and has 6 weeks to live. As her husband, he's her only heir. Nice spot to be in.
Yeah.
Only he isn't her husband.
Huh?
Because the Mexican divorce from his first wife, the late Beth Jardine Hawks, wasn't legal, you know.
What?
She blew in a month ago and began shaking him down after leaving the marriage certificate and a batch of other papers with some lawyers for life insurance.
Sam, I just ain't interested.
When you hear the payoff, Croc, it's just like the dame with letters.
What do you mean?
Hawks hired someone to crack the lawyer's office and get the papers out of the safe. Some smart guy, yeah. An unfrocked private eye who doesn't have a license. I found out where he had the photostats made, though. I can get copies.
Hey, for clean up, I'll shut up.
A
closet doorknob was turning slowly. I waved him out of the way and picked up the chair. It was all over 2 seconds after it started. The door flew open. He came out with his terrible secret, which turned out to be a gun. And I wrapped the chair right around his head. So I picked up the gun and Croc and young Dr. Hawks, and we all picked up a ride to headquarters. Only one scene remained to be played in today's exciting episode.
Oh, I should try to be brave, Mr. Spade. It sounds like such a cliche now.
Good show, Agatha. Good show.
Life must go on, you know. Even when a woman...
You were born in 1911, I believe.
Yes. As I say, life must go on, even when a woman...
Indeed it must. Indeed it must. We have our happy moments and our sad ones. Our pleasures, our trials, our joys, and our heartbreaks.
And sometimes, Mr. Spade...
Yes?
Sometimes at the bottom of our cup of bitterness, we find a pool.
We do?
The laboratory, sir.
A mistake, definitely. They got yours mixed up with someone else's, and you have no incurable disease and many years of happiness ahead of you.
Yes, Mr. Spade. But happiness? I wonder. Can a woman past 40... whose husband is a convicted murderer, find happiness? Alone?
Good show. Period. End of opera.
Oh, say. Sam, I can't wait for tomorrow's episode.
I'll be sure to tune in at this very same time, Cherub, and meanwhile, answer me this. How long will it take a woman past 20 to turn out a 25-page report?
Yes, sir. I'll have the answer after a brief word from our announcer.
Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Tomorrow, Arturo Toscanini will conduct the renowned NBC Symphony in the fourth of a Saturday concert series. For tomorrow's one-hour performance, celebrated Maestro Toscanini has chosen works by Debussy, Respighi, and Edward Elgar. You're invited tomorrow to the NBC Symphony and Toscanini.
Oh, dear.
Oh, there, little girl. No tears now, no tears.
They're tears of gratitude, Sam. When I read all this about other people's troubles, I'm so grateful to you for the smooth life we have together.
Effie.
Sam.
That takes about 10 seconds. Go ahead.
I'm only merely a secretary, but...
Shh. Over now. Matter of fact, we're 10 seconds over.
Oh, well, Sam, I haven't even your wife to be versus...
Nothing but peace and quiet.
And fairly regular paycheck.
With only a corpse now and then to produce a ripple on the mirror's smoothness of our bliss.
Oh, that's beautiful, Sam.
I thought so.
You don't have a single terrible secret, either.
No, but just to keep you interested, dear one, from time to time I shall pick up a piece of paper, read it, let the blood drain slowly from my face, then clasp you to me thusly.
Sam!
Holding you close, and just before striding silently from the room, mutter in your shell-pink ear.
I know. Good night, Sam.
Good night, sweetheart. The Adventures of Sam Spade are produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Sam Spade was played by Stephen Dunn. Lorene Tuttle as Effie. Script for tonight's adventure by Harold Swanton. Musical scoring by Lud Bluskin, conducted by Robert Armbruster. Join us again next week, same time, for another adventure with Sam Spade. Join the Magnificent Montague and have fun at Duffy's Tavern on NBC.
Next, we'll hear from a real soap opera. This is soap opera that a lot of guys secretly listen to because it's Perry Mason, and this is the Honeymoon Murder case from 1950.
We're back in Judge Newman's courtroom. Outside, the early winter twilight has set in. At the defense table, a man and a woman sit close, their heads together. Martha and Donald Smith, accused of the murder of Wilfred Palmer. Paying no attention to the spectators who watch them so hungrily, Donald puts his arm around his wife, whispers, "Darling."
Oh, Donald.
Don't act so trapped.
That's how I feel, darling.
Don't.
I feel so strangely. I can hardly breathe.
But you must.
I can't stand much more of this. Those eyes boring into my back, those voices, those awful
Martha,
people.
court's almost over for today. You'll be fine after another night's sleep.
I'll never sleep again. I never want to sleep again. Or if I do, I hope I never wake up. Oh, no, I don't mean that.
I know.
I want to wake. I want to live. I want to be with you.
You will be. You will be, darling. Just leave it to Mr. Mason.
I will, but...
And after this is all over, we'll have our honeymoon. A real honeymoon.
You think so, Donald? Do you really think so?
Of course I do. Now, give me a kiss.
Here?
Right here. In front of Judge Newman, Prosecutor Noble, and everybody.
And at the other end of the defense table, we hear...
4:05, Chief.
What, Donald?
It's after 4. Yeah. Think Noble will be able to wind up his prosecution this afternoon?
Well, he said he would. I guess he will, too, if he gets Trag in here. Oh. That Donald is being a good boy, isn't he, Donald?
Hmm?
Look at him. At the other end of the table with Martha there.
No, they're sweet.
Yes.
They don't deserve this. It's almost time for the mystery witness, isn't it?
Yes, I imagine. After Trag. After Noble introduces Martha's glove.
Then, now he wheels up the big guns?
Yes, now he wheels up the big guns.
Yes, Lieutenant Trag, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Noble. Let's proceed.
I'll take over with Trag, Dillon. See what they can do to spike those big guns.
Take the stand, Lieutenant.
Yes.
You've already been sworn.
Yes, sir.
Now, Lieutenant, I show you this object. Will you tell us what it is and if you've ever seen it before?
It's a woman's glove.
And?
The first time I saw it, it was handed to me by Detective Levinsky.
You have a sworn statement by Detective Levinsky?
Right here.
Please tell the court about it.
The glove was found by Levinsky on the service stairs during our investigation on the night of the murder.
Where, Lieutenant?
On the service stairs, right off the landing where Palmer's apartment was.
And this is the same glove?
I put a tag on it. Levinsky signed the tag here. I signed it blown here. Date and time it was found.
I see. Now, Lieutenant, there's a stain on the glove.
That's right.
You had the stain analyzed?
I did.
And what made the stain?
Blood. Human blood.
Oh, but I explained that! I explained that I cut my finger!
Miss, sit down.
Sit down.
Oh, don't you see what they're... Oh.
Go on, Mr. Noble.
You have a statement from a laboratory chemist, Lieutenant Trag? I mean, to the effect that the stain is human blood?
I do.
So this blood-stained glove was found on the stairway leading to the floor on which Palmer's apartment was located?
Well, yes, of course, but...
You tried to find the owner of the glove?
Yes.
Were you successful?
Yes.
Will you tell the court how you did ascertain ownership of the glove?
Just a moment. Your Honor, we admit ownership of this glove. I object to further testimony on that point on the grounds that such testimony is immaterial and irrelevant.
Sustained.
Well, Trag, you determined who owned the glove.
Yes.
Then what did you do?
Started looking for Martha Smith. We found her registered in a small hotel.
Under what circumstances, Trag?
She was with her husband, her lawyer, Perry Mason, and his secretary, Miss Street.
And what were they about to do?
Objection. How would Lieutenant Trag know what we were about to do?
Sustained.
What were these people doing when you found them, Lieutenant?
Talking. The door was open.
Go on.
Miss Street and Mrs. Smith had traded coats.
Traded coats?
Miss Street had on Martha's coat, a tan one, and Mrs. Smith was wearing Miss Street's, a blue one. But they weren't trying to get away or anything.
That's enough. Your witness, Mr. Mason.
Thank you. Now, Lieutenant Trag.
Yes, sir.
You say Mrs. Smith's glove was found on the stairs leading to the floor of Palmer's apartment?
Well, that's true, but...
Isn't it a fact that those stairs connect with all floors of the building?
They sure do.
So it's impossible to say where whoever dropped that glove had been or was going.
That's right, Mr. Mason.
Yeah. Now to get on, Lieutenant. You have a report from the chemist who analyzed the stain on that glove?
It was blood, human blood, Mr. Mason.
Was the blood typed?
Why, no.
The chemist didn't determine the blood type?
He couldn't.
But he did manage to make out it was human blood.
That's right.
But since it couldn't be typed, there's no way of telling whose blood it was. Am I right?
Absolutely. It could have been anyone's.
Now, Lieutenant Trag, you say Martha Smith disappeared after the murder.
That's right. We couldn't find her for a couple of days.
I see. Now, let me ask you this. Was there a warrant issued for her arrest when she disappeared?
Why, no.
Did the newspapers know you were looking for Martha Smith and publish that fact?
They did not.
Then, as a matter of fact, there was no way in which Martha Smith could have learned the authorities were looking for her.
No.
Further, as far as you know, her disappearance might well have been natural and legal.
Yes.
And when you found her, with her husband, Miss Street, and myself, did she make any attempt to escape?
She'd traded coats.
Ah, yes. She'd traded coats. And you thought that significant?
I did.
Especially since Mrs. Smith's coat was tan.
Well, we got reports there was a woman in a tan coat outside Palmer's apartment.
The important tan coat?
Yes.
The one you searched for so thoroughly in Palmer's building? You did search for the tan coat, didn't you?
Well, no.
So, you found this girl, who had no way of knowing you were searching for her. You found her in the company of her husband and her lawyer. And because she was not wearing a tan coat, you arrested her?
Look here, Mason. I had the glove and that coat.
Just... Oh, then you'd have arrested her anyway, with or without the tan coat.
Sure.
Then the tan coat can't be so important.
But it is. I mean, just because she wasn't wearing it, I wish I'd never heard of a tan coat.
I can see why. That's all, Lieutenant Trank.
Next witness, please.
Well, that's that baggage. Now we get down to it.
Miss Helen Whitlock, take the stand, please.
Helen Whitlock?
Yes, I heard.
What interest could Helen Whitlock have in a case like this?
I don't know. But I'm going to find out.
Now, where do you live, Miss Whitlock?
363 Lincoln. The building in which the murder was committed.
Oh, yes. Yes, I think you were in the deceased's apartment when the police arrived.
I was. I was startled by a scream. I went to help Mrs. Powers. She's the building manager.
Now, try and put that terrible scene from your mind, Miss Whitlock.
I'll try.
And tell us, did you know the murdered man?
Well, not really.
But you'd seen him?
Well, we lived on the same floor.
I understand. Now, I ask you, Miss Whitlock, I ask you if you know the defendant, Martha Smith.
Well, I don't know her.
But you've seen her before.
Yes.
Please speak up, Miss Whitlock. No matter how painful it may be, I shall have to ask you where you saw her before.
Well, the last time, in a police lineup.
I see. You identified her in a police lineup, Miss Whitlock.
I did.
And how could you identify her, Miss Whitlock? Had you seen her previously?
I hadn't.
Miss Whitlock, I ask you, where did you see Martha Smith before?
I...
Speak up, Miss Whitlock.
All right, I'll tell you. I saw her coming out of Wilfred Palmer's apartment about 2 minutes after he was murdered. That's where I saw her. That's where I saw her.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.